ends his suspicion, I hand him an assortment of photographs I'd taken on a trip to Alaska the previous summer, during which I'd retraced McCandless's terminal journey on the Stampede Trail. The first several images in the stack are landscapes, shots of the surrounding bush, the overgrown trail, distant mountains, the Shoshana River. Franz studies them in silence, occasionally nodding when I explain what they depict. He seems grateful to see them. When he comes to the pictures of the bus in which the boy died, however, he stiffens abruptly. Several of these images show McCandless's belongings inside the derelict vehicle. As soon as Franz realizes what he's seeing, his eyes mist over. He thrusts the photos back at me without examining the rest, and the old man walks away to compose himself as I mumble a lame apology. Franz no longer lives at McCandless's campsite. A flash flood washed the makeshift road away, so he moved 20 miles out, toward the Borrego Badlands, where he camps beside an isolated stand of cottonwoods. Oh My God Hot Springs is gone now, too, bulldozed and plugged with concrete by order of the Imperial Valley Health Commission. County officials say they eliminated the springs out of concern that bathers might become gravely ill from virulent microbes thought to flourish in the thermal pools. That sure could have been true, says the clerk at the Salton City store, but most people think they bulldozed them 'cause the springs was starting to attract too many hippies and drifters and scum like that. Good riddance, you ask me. For more than 8 months after he said goodbye to McCandless, Franz remained at his campsite, scanning the road for the approach of a young man with a large pack, waiting patiently for Alex to return. During the last week of 1992, the day after Christmas, he picked up 2 hitchhikers on his way back from a trip into Salton City to check his mail. One fellow was from Mississippi, I think. The other was a Native American, Franz remembers. On the way out to the hot springs, I started telling them about my friend Alex and the adventure he'd set out to have in Alaska. Suddenly, the Indian youth interrupted. Was his name Alex McCandless? Yes, that's right. So you've met him, then? I hate to tell you this, mister, but your friend is dead. Froze to death up on the tundra. Just read about it in Outdoor Magazine. In shock, Franz interrogated the hitchhiker at length. The details rang true. His story added up. Something had gone horribly wrong. McCandless would never be coming back. When Alex left for Alaska, Franz remembers, I prayed. I asked God to keep his finger on the shoulder of that one. I told him that boy was special. But he let Alex die. So on December 26th, when I learned what happened, I renounced the Lord. I withdrew my church membership and became an atheist. I decided I couldn't believe in a God who would let something that terrible happen to a boy like Alex. After I dropped off the hitchhikers, Franz continues, I turned my van around, drove back to the store, and bought a bottle of whiskey. And then I went out into the desert and drank it. I wasn't used to drinking, so it made me sick. Hoped it'd kill me, but it didn't. Just made me real, real sick. Chapter 7. Carthage. There was some books. One was Pilgrim's Progress, about a man that left his family. It didn't say why. I read considerable in it now and then. The statements was interesting, but tough. Mark Twain, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. It is true that many creative people fail to make mature personal relationships, and some are extremely isolated. It is also true that in some instances, trauma, in the shape of early separation or bereavement, has steered the potentially creative person toward developing aspects of his personality which can find fulfillment in comparative isolation. But this does not mean that solitary creative pursuits are themselves pathological. Avoidance behavior is a response designed to protect the infant from behavioral disorganization. If we transfer this concept to adult life, we can see that an avoidant infant might very well develop into a person whose principal need was to find some kind of meaning and order in life which was not entirely, or even chiefly, dependent upon interpersonal relationships. Anthony Storr, Solitude, A Return to the Self. The big John Deere 8020 squats silently in the canted evening light, a a long way from anywhere, surrounded by a half-mowed field of South Dakota Milo. Wayne Westerberg's muddy sneakers protrude from the maw of the combine, as if the machine were in the process of swallowing him whole, an overgrown metal reptile digesting its prey. "Hand me that goddamn wrench, will you?" an angry, muffled voice demands from deep within the machine's innards. "Or are you guys too busy standing around with your hands in your goddamn pockets to be of any use?" The combine has broken down for the third time in as many days, and Westerberg is frantically trying to replace a hard-to-reach bushing before nightfall. An hour later, he emerges, smeared with grease and chaff, but successful. "Sorry about snapping like that," Westerberg apologizes. "We've been working too many 18-hour days. I guess I'm getting a little snarly, it being so late in the season and all, and us being short-handed besides. We was counting on Alex being back at work by now." 50 days have gone by since McCandless's body was discovered in Alaska on the Stampede Trail. 7 months earlier, on a frosty March afternoon, McCandless had ambled into the office at the Carthage Grain Elevator and announced that he was ready to go to work. "There we were, ringing up the morning's tickets," remembers Westerberg, "and in walks Alex with a big old backpack slung over his shoulder. He told Westerberg he planned on staying until April 15th, just long enough to put together a grub stake. He needed to buy a pile of new gear, he explained, because he was going to Alaska. McCandless promised to come back to South Dakota in time to help with the autumn harvest, but he wanted to be in Fairbanks by the end of April in order to squeeze in as much time as possible up north before his return. During those 4 weeks in Carthage, McCandless worked hard, doing dirty, tedious jobs that nobody else wanted to tackle, mucking out warehouses, exterminating vermin, painting, scything weeds. At one point, to reward McCandless with a task that involved slightly more skill, Westerberg attempted to teach him to operate a front-end loader. "Alex hadn't been around machinery much," Westerberg says with a shake of his head, "and it was pretty comical to watch him try to get the hang of the clutch and all those levers. He definitely wasn't what you'd call mechanically minded." Nor was McCandless endowed with a surfeit of common sense. Many who knew him have commented, unbidden, that he seemed to have great difficulty seeing the trees, as it were, for the forest. "Alex wasn't a total space cadet or anything," says Westerberg. "Don't get me wrong. But there was gaps in his thinking. I remember once I went over to the house, walked into the kitchen, and noticed a god-awful stink. I mean, it smelled nasty in there. I opened the microwave, and the bottom of it was filled with rancid grease. Alex had been using it to cook chicken, and it never occurred to him that the grease had to drain somewhere. It wasn't that he was too lazy to clean it up. Alex always kept things real neat and orderly. It was just that he hadn't noticed the grease." Soon after McCandless returned to Carthage that spring, Westerberg introduced him to his longtime on-again, off-again girlfriend, Gail Bora, a petite, sad-eyed woman, as slight as a heron, with delicate features and long blonde hair. 35 years old, divorced, a mother of 2 teenage children, she quickly became close to McCandless. "He was kind of shy at first," says Bora. "He acted like it was hard for him to be around people. I just figured that was because he'd spent so much time by himself." "I had Alex over to the house for supper just about every night," Bora continues. "He was a big eater. Never left any food on his plate. Never. He was a good cook, too. Sometimes he'd have me over to Wayne's place and fix supper for everybody. Cooked a lot of rice. You'd think he would get tired of it, but he never did. Said he could live for a month on nothing but 25 pounds of rice." "Alex talked a lot when we got together," Bora recalls. "Serious stuff, like he was bearing his soul, kind of. He said he could tell me things that he couldn't tell the others. You could see something was gnawing at him. It was pretty obvious he didn't get along with his family, but he never said much about any of them except Corrine, his little sister. He said they were pretty close. Said she was beautiful, that when she walked down the street, guys would turn their heads and stare." Westerberg, for his part, didn't concern himself with McCandless's family problems. "Whatever reason he had for being pissed off, I figured it must have been a good one. Now that he's dead, though, I don't know anymore. If Alex was here right now, I'd be tempted to chew him out good. What the hell were you thinking? Not speaking to your family for all that time? Treating them like dirt? One of the kids that works for me, fuck, he don't even have any goddamn parents. But you don't hear him bitching. Whatever the deal was with Alex's family, I guarantee you I've seen a lot worse. Knowing Alex, I think he must have just got stuck on something that happened between him and his dad and couldn't leave it be. Westerberg's latter conjecture, as it turned out, was a fairly astute analysis of the relationship between Chris and Walt McCandless. Both father and son were stubborn and high-strung. Given Walt's need to exert control and Chris's extravagantly independent nature, polarization was inevitable. Chris submitted to Walt's authority through high school and college to a surprising degree, but the boy raged inwardly all the while. He brooded at length over what he perceived to be his father's moral shortcomings, the hypocrisy of his parents' lifestyle, the tyranny of their conditional love. Eventually, Chris rebelled, and when he finally did, it was with characteristic immoderation. Shortly before he disappeared, Chris complained to Corrine that their parents' behavior was so irrational, so oppressive, disrespectful, and insulting that I finally passed my breaking point. He went on, "Since they won't ever take me seriously, for a few months after graduation, I'm going to let them think they are right. I'm going to let them think that I'm coming around to see their side of things, and that our relationship is stabilizing. And then, once the time is right, with one abrupt, swift action, I'm going to completely knock them out of my life. I'm going to divorce them as my parents once and for all and never speak to either of those idiots again as long as I live. I'll be through with them once and for all, forever." The chill Westerberg sensed between Alex and his parents stood in marked contrast to the warmth McCandless exhibited in Carthage. Outgoing and extremely personable when the spirit moved him, he charmed a lot of folks. There was mail waiting for him when he arrived back in South Dakota, correspondence from people he'd met on the road, including what Westerberg remembers as letters from a girl who had a big crush on him, someone he'd gotten to know in some Timbuktu, some campground, I think. But McCandless never mentioned any romantic entanglements to either Westerberg or Bora. "I don't recollect Alex ever talking about any girlfriends," says Westerberg, "although a couple of times he mentioned wanting to get married and have a family someday. You could tell he didn't take relationships lightly. He wasn't the kind of guy who would go out and pick up girls just to get laid." It was clear to Bora, too, that McCandless hadn't spent much time cruising singles bars. "One night, a bunch of us went out to a bar over in Madison," says Bora, "and it was hard to get him out on the dance floor. But once he was out there, he wouldn't sit down. We had a blast."
"After Alex died and all, Corrine told me that as far as she knew, I was one of the only girls he ever went dancing with." In high school, McCandless had enjoyed a close rapport with two or three members of the opposite sex, and Corrine recalls one instance when he got drunk and tried to bring a girl up to his bedroom in the middle of the night. They made so much noise stumbling up the stairs that Billy was awakened and sent the girl home. But there is little evidence that he was sexually active as a teenager, and even less to suggest that he slept with any woman after graduating from high school. Nor, for that matter, is there any evidence that he was ever sexually intimate with a man. It seems that McCandless was drawn to women, but remained largely or entirely celibate, as chaste as a monk. Chastity and moral purity were qualities McCandless mulled over long and often. Indeed, one of the books found in the bus with his remains was a collection of stories that included Tolstoy's The Kreutzer Sonata, in which the nobleman-turned-ascetic denounces the demands of the flesh. Several such passages are starred and highlighted in the dog-eared text, the margins filled with cryptic notes printed in McCandless's distinctive hand. And in the chapter on higher laws in Thoreau's Walden, a copy of which was also discovered in the bus, McCandless circled, "Chastity is the flowering of man, and what are called genius, heroism, holiness, and the like are but various fruits which succeed it." We Americans are titillated by sex, obsessed by it, horrified by it. When an apparently healthy person, especially a healthy young man, elects to forego the enticements of the flesh, it shocks us and we leer. Suspicions are aroused. McCandless's apparent sexual innocence, however, is a corollary of a personality type that our culture purports to admire, at least in the case of its more famous adherents. His ambivalence toward sex echoes that of celebrated others who embraced wilderness with single-minded passion, Thoreau, who was a lifelong virgin, and the naturalist John Muir, most prominently, to say nothing of countless lesser-known pilgrims, seekers, misfits, and adventurers. Like not a few of those seduced by the wild, McCandless seems to have been driven by a variety of lust that supplanted sexual desire. His yearning, in a sense, was too powerful to be quenched by human contact. McCandless may have been tempted by the succor offered by women, but it paled beside the prospect of rough congress with nature, with the cosmos itself. And thus was he drawn north, to Alaska. McCandless assured both Westerberg and Bora that when his northern sojourn was over, he would return to South Dakota, at least for the fall. After that, it would depend. I got the impression that this Alaska escapade was going to be his last big adventure, Westerberg offers, and that he wanted to settle down some. He said he was going to write a book about his travels. He liked Carthage. With his education, nobody thought he was going to work at a goddamn grain elevator the rest of his life, but he definitely intended to come back here for a while, help us out at the elevator, figure out what he was going to do next. That spring, however, McCandless's sights were fixed unflinchingly on Alaska. He talked about the trip at every opportunity. He sought out experienced hunters around town and asked them for tips about stalking game, dressing animals, curing meat. Bora drove him to the Kmart in Mitchell to shop for some last pieces of gear. By mid-April, Westerberg was both shorthanded and very busy, so he asked McCandless to postpone his departure and work a week or two longer. McCandless wouldn't even consider it. Once Alex made up his mind about something, there was no changing it, Westerberg laments. I even offered to buy him a plane ticket to Fairbanks, which would have let him work an extra 10 days and still get to Alaska by the end of April. But he said, no, I want to hitch north. Flying would be cheating. It would wreck the whole trip. 2 nights before McCandless was scheduled to head north, Mary Westerberg, Wayne's mother, invited him to her house for dinner. My mom doesn't like a lot of my hired help, Westerberg says, and she wasn't real enthusiastic about meeting Alex either. But I kept bugging her, telling her, you gotta meet this kid. And so she finally had him over for supper. They hit it off immediately. The two of them talked nonstop for 5 hours. There was something fascinating about him, explains Mrs. Westerberg, seated at the polished walnut table where McCandless dined that night. Alex struck me as much older than 24. Everything I said, he'd demand to know more about what I meant, about why I thought this way or that. He was hungry to learn about things. Unlike most of us, he was the sort of person who insisted on living out his beliefs. We talked for hours about books. There aren't that many people in Carthage who like to talk about books. He went on and on about Mark Twain. Gosh, he was fun to visit with. I didn't want the night to end. I was greatly looking forward to seeing him again this fall. I can't get him out of my mind. I keep picturing his face. He sat in the same chair you're sitting in now. Considering that I only spent a few hours in Alex's company, it amazes me how much I'm bothered by his death. On McCandless's final night in Carthage, he partied hard at the cabaret with Westerberg's crew. The Jack Daniels flowed freely. To everyone's surprise, McCandless sat down at the piano, which he'd never mentioned he knew how to play, and started pounding out honky-tonk country tunes, then ragtime, then Tony Bennett numbers. And he wasn't merely a drunk inflicting his delusions of talent on a captive audience. Alex, says Gail Bora, could really play. I mean, he was good. We were all blown away by it. On the morning of April 15th, everybody gathered at the elevator to see McCandless off. His pack was heavy. He had approximately $1,000 tucked in his boot. He left his journal and photo album with Westerberg for safekeeping and gave him the leather belt he'd made in the desert. Alex used to sit at the bar in the cabaret and read that belt for hours on end, says Westerberg, like he was translating hieroglyphics for us. Each picture he'd carved into the leather had a long story behind it. When McCandless hugged Bora goodbye, she says, I noticed he was crying. That frightened me. He wasn't planning on being gone all that long. I figured he wouldn't have been crying unless he intended to take some big risks and knew he might not be coming back. That's when I started having a bad feeling that we wouldn't never see Alex again. A big tractor semi-trailer rig was idling out front. Rod Wolf, one of Westerberg's employees, needed to haul a load of sunflower seeds to Enderlin, North Dakota, and had agreed to drive McCandless to Interstate 94. "When I let him off, he had that big damn machete hanging off his shoulder," Wolf says. "I thought, geez, nobody's gonna pick him up when they see that thing." But I didn't say nothing about it. I just shook his hand, wished him good luck, and told him he'd better write. McCandless did. A week later, Westerberg received a terse card with a Montana postmark. "April 18th. Arrived in Whitefish this morning on a freight train. I am making good time. Today I will jump the border and turn north for Alaska. Give my regards to everyone. Take care. Alex." Then, in early May, Westerberg received another postcard, this one from Alaska, with a photo of a polar bear on the front. It was postmarked April 27th, 1992. "Greetings from Fairbanks," it reads. "This is the last you shall hear from me, Wayne. Arrived here 2 days ago. It was very difficult to catch rides in the Yukon Territory, but I finally got here. Please return all mail I receive to the sender. It might be a very long time before I return south. If this adventure proves fatal, and you don't ever hear from me again, I want you to know you're a great man. I now walk into the wild. Alex." On the same date, McCandless sent a card bearing a similar message to Jan Burris and Bob. "Hey, guys, this is the last communication you shall receive from me. I now walk out to live amongst the wild. Take care. It was great knowing you. Alexander." Chapter 8. Alaska. It may, after all, be the bad habit of creative talents to invest themselves in pathological extremes that yield remarkable insights, but no durable way of life for those who cannot translate their psychic wounds into significant art or thought. Theodore Rosak, In Search of the Miraculous. We have in America the big two-hearted river tradition. Taking your wounds to the wilderness for a cure, a conversion, a rest, or whatever. And as in the Hemingway story, if your wounds aren't too bad, it works. But this isn't Michigan, or Faulkner's Big Woods in Mississippi for that matter. This is Alaska. Edward Hoagland, Up the Black to Chokiyitsik. When McCandless turned up dead in Alaska, and the perplexing circumstances of his demise were reported in the news media, many people concluded that the boy must have been mentally disturbed.
This book is continued on Disc 3. Disc 3.
When McCandless turned up dead in Alaska, and the perplexing circumstances of his demise were reported in the news media, many people concluded that the boy must have been mentally disturbed. The article about McCandless in Outside generated a large volume of mail, and not a few of the letters heaped opprobrium on McCandless, and on me as well, the author of the story, for glorifying what some thought was a foolish, pointless death. Much of the negative mail was sent by Alaskans. "Alex is a nut in my book," wrote a resident of Healy, the hamlet at the head of the Stampede Trail. "The author describes a man who has given away a small fortune, forsaken a loving family, abandoned his car, watch, and map, and burned the last of his money before traipsing off into the wilderness west of Healy. Personally, I see nothing positive at all about Chris McCandless's lifestyle or wilderness doctrine," scolded another correspondent. "Entering the wilderness purposefully ill-prepared and surviving a near-death experience does not make you a better human. It makes you damn lucky." One reader of the Outside piece wondered, why would anyone intending to live off the land for a few months forget Boy Scout rule number one, be prepared? Why would any son cause his parents and family such permanent and perplexing pain? "Krakauer is a kook if he doesn't think Chris Alexander Supertramp McCandless was a kook," opined a man from North Pole, Alaska. McCandless had already gone over the edge and just happened to hit bottom in Alaska. The most strident criticism came in the form of a dense, multi-page epistle from Ambler, a tiny Inupiat village on the Kobuk River, north of the Arctic Circle. The author was a white writer and schoolteacher, formerly from Washington, D.C., named Nick Jans. Warning that it was 1 a.m. and he was well into a bottle of Seagram's, Jans let fly. Over the past 15 years, I've run into several McCandless types out in the country. Same story. Idealistic, energetic young guys who overestimated themselves, underestimated the country, and ended up in trouble. McCandless was hardly unique. There's quite a few of these guys hanging around the state, so much alike that they're almost a collective cliché. The only difference is that McCandless ended up dead, with the story of his dumbassedness splashed across the media. Jack London got it right in To Build a Fire. McCandless is finally just a pale 20th century burlesque of London's protagonist, who freezes because he ignores advice and commits big-time hubris. His ignorance, which could have been cured by a USGS quadrant and a Boy Scout manual, is what killed him, and while I feel for his parents, I have no sympathy for him. Such willful ignorance amounts to disrespect for the land and paradoxically demonstrates the same sort of arrogance that resulted in the Exxon Valdez spill, just another case of underprepared, overconfident men bumbling around out there and screwing up because they lack the requisite humility. It's all a matter of degree. McCandless's contrived asceticism and pseudo-literary stance compound rather than reduce the fault. McCandless's postcards, notes, and journals read like the work of an above-average, somewhat histrionic high school kid. Or am I missing something? The prevailing Alaska wisdom held that McCandless was simply one more dreamy, half-cocked greenhorn who went into the country expecting to find answers to all his problems and instead found only mosquitoes and a lonely death. Dozens of marginal characters have marched off into the Alaska wilds over the years, never to reappear. A few have lodged firmly in the state's collective memory. There was the countercultural idealist who passed through the village of Tanana in the early 1970s, announcing that he intended to spend the rest of his life communing with nature. In midwinter, a field biologist discovered all his belongings, two rifles, camping gear, a diary filled with incoherent ranting about truth and beauty and recondite ecological theory, in an empty cabin near Tofty, its interior filled with drifted snow. No trace of the young man was ever found. A few years later, there was the Vietnam vet who built a cabin on the Black River east of Chokoyetsik to get away from people. By February, he'd run out of food and starved, apparently without making any attempt to save himself, despite the fact that there was another cabin stocked with meat just 3 miles downstream. Writing about his death, Edward Hoagland observed that Alaska is not the best site in the world for eremitic experiments or peace-love theatrics. And then there was the wayward genius I bumped into on the shore of Prince William Sound in 1981. I was camped in the woods outside Cordova, Alaska, trying in vain to find work as a deckhand on a seine boat, biding my time until the Department of Fish and Game announced the first opener, the start of the commercial salmon season. One rainy afternoon, while walking into town, I crossed paths with an unkempt, agitated man who appeared to be about 40. He wore a bush-like black beard and shoulder-length hair, which he kept out of his face with a headband made from a filthy nylon strap. He was walking toward me at a brisk clip, hunched beneath the considerable weight of a 6-foot log balanced across one shoulder. I said hello as he approached, he mumbled a reply, and we paused to chat in the drizzle. I didn't ask why he was carrying a sodden log into the forest, where there seemed to be plenty of logs already. After a few minutes spent exchanging earnest banalities, we went our separate ways. From our brief conversation, I deduced that I had just met the celebrated eccentric whom the locals called the Mayor of Hippie Cove, a reference to a bight of tidewater north of town that was a magnet for long-haired transients, near which the mayor had been living for some years. Most of the residents of Hippie Cove were, like me, summer squatters who'd come to Cordova hoping to score high-paying fishing jobs, or, failing that, find work in the salmon canneries. But the mayor was different. His real name was Gene Rossellini. He was the eldest stepson of Victor Rossellini, a wealthy Seattle restaurateur, and cousin of Albert Rossellini, the immensely popular governor of Washington State from 1957 to 1965. As a young man, Gene had been a good athlete and a brilliant student. He read obsessively, practiced yoga, became expert at the martial arts. He sustained a perfect 4.0 grade point average through high school and college. At the University of Washington and later at Seattle University, he immersed himself in anthropology, history, philosophy, and linguistics, accumulating hundreds of credit hours without collecting a degree. He saw no reason to. The pursuit of knowledge, he maintained, was a worthy objective in its own right and needed no external validation. By and by, Rossellini left academia, departed Seattle, and drifted north up the coast through British Columbia and the Alaska Panhandle. In 1977, he landed in Cordova. There, in the forest at the edge of town, he decided to devote his life to an ambitious anthropological experiment. "I was interested in knowing if it was possible to be independent of modern technology," he told an Anchorage Daily News reporter, Deborah McKinney, a decade after arriving in Cordova. He wondered whether humans could live as our forebears had when mammoths and saber-toothed tigers roamed the land, or whether our species had moved too far from its roots to survive without gunpowder, steel, and other artifacts of civilization. With the obsessive attention to detail that characterized his brand of dogged genius, Rossellini purged his life of all but the most primitive tools, which he fashioned from native materials with his own hands. He became convinced that humans had devolved into progressively inferior beings, McKinney explains, and it was his goal to return to a natural state. He was forever experimenting with different eras, Roman times, the Iron Age, the Bronze Age. By the end, his lifestyle had elements of the Neolithic. He dined on roots, berries, and seaweed, hunted game with spears and snares, dressed in rags, endured the bitter winters. He seemed to relish the hardship. His home above Hippie Cove was a windowless hovel, which he built without benefit of saw or axe. "He'd spend days," says McKinney, "grinding his way through a log with a sharp stone." As if merely subsisting according to his self-imposed rules weren't strenuous enough, Rossellini also exercised compulsively whenever he wasn't occupied with foraging. He filled his days with calisthenics, weightlifting, and running, often with a load of rocks on his back. During one apparently typical summer, he reported covering an average of 18 miles daily. Rossellini's experiment stretched on for more than a decade, but eventually he felt the question that inspired it had been answered. In a letter to a friend, he wrote, "I began my adult life with the hypothesis that it would be possible to become a Stone Age native. For over 30 years, I programmed and conditioned myself to this end. In the last 10 of it, I would say I realistically experienced the physical, mental, and emotional reality of the Stone Age. But to borrow a Buddhist phrase, eventually came a setting face to face with pure reality. I learned that it is not possible for human beings as we know them to live off the land." Rossellini appeared to accept the failure of his hypothesis with equanimity. At the age of 49, he cheerfully announced that he had recast his goals and next intended to walk around the world, living out of my backpack. "I want to cover 18 to 27 miles a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year." The trip never got off the ground. In November 1991, Rossellini was discovered lying face down on the floor of his shack with a knife through his heart. The coroner determined that the fatal wound was self-inflicted. There was no suicide note. Rossellini left no hint as to why he had decided to end his life then and in that manner. In all likelihood, nobody will ever know. Rossellini's death and the story of his outlandish existence made the front page of the Anchorage Daily News. The travails of John Mallon Waterman, however, attracted less attention. Born in 1952, Waterman was raised in the same Washington suburbs that gave shape to Chris McCandless. His father, Guy Waterman, is a musician and freelance writer who, among other claims to modest fame, authored speeches for presidents, ex-presidents, and other prominent Washington politicians. Waterman Pear also happens to be an expert mountaineer who taught his three sons to climb at an early age. John, the middle son, went rock climbing for the first time at 13. He was a natural. John headed to the crags at every opportunity and trained obsessively when he couldn't climb. He cranked out 400 push-ups every day and walked 2.5 miles to school fast. After walking home in the afternoon, he'd touch the front door and head back to the school to make a second round trip. In 1969, as a 16-year-old, John climbed Mount McKinley, which he called Denali, as most Alaskans do, preferring the peak's Athapascan name, becoming the third youngest person to stand atop the highest landform on the continent. Over the next few years, he pulled off even more impressive ascents in Alaska, Canada, and Europe. By the time he enrolled in the University of Alaska at Fairbanks in 1973, Waterman had established a reputation as one of the most promising young alpinists in North America. Waterman was a small person, barely 5'3" tall, with an elfin face and the sinewy, inexhaustible physique of a gymnast. Acquaintances remember him as a socially awkward man-child with an outrageous sense of humor and a squirrely, almost manic-depressive personality. "When I first met John," says James Brady, a fellow climber and college friend, "he was prancing across campus in a long black cape and blue Elton John-type glasses that had a star between the lenses. He carried around a cheap guitar held together with masking tape and would serenade anybody who'd listen with long, off-key songs about his adventures. Fairbanks has always attracted a lot of weird characters, but he was wacky even by Fairbanks standards. Yeah, John was out there. A lot of people didn't know how to handle him." It is not difficult to imagine plausible causes for Waterman's instability. His parents, Guy and Emily Waterman, divorced when he was a teen, and Guy, according to a source close to the family, essentially abandoned his sons following the divorce. He would have nothing more to do with the boys, and it crippled John badly. Not long after their parents split up, John and his older brother Bill went to visit their father, but Guy refused to see them. Shortly after that, John and Bill went to Fairbanks to live with an uncle. At one point while they were up there, John got very excited because he heard that his father was coming to Alaska to climb. But when Guy arrived in the state, he never took the trouble to see his sons. He came and went without even bothering to visit. It broke John's heart. Bill, with whom John had an extremely close relationship, lost a leg as a teenager trying to hop a freight train. In 1973, Bill posted an enigmatic letter alluding vaguely to plans for an extended trip and then disappeared without a trace. To this day, nobody knows what became of him. And after John learned to climb, 8 of his intimates and climbing partners were killed in accidents or committed suicide. It's not much of a stretch to posit that such a rash of misfortune dealt a serious blow to Waterman's young psyche. In March 1978, Waterman embarked on his most astonishing expedition, a solo ascent of Mount Hunter's southeast spur, an unclimbed route that had previously defeated 3 teams of elite mountaineers. Writing about the feat in Climbing magazine, the journalist Glenn Randall reported that Waterman described his companions on the climb as the wind, the snow, and death. Cornices as airy as meringue jutted over voids a mile deep. The vertical ice walls were as crumbly as a bucket of ice cubes half-thawed, then refrozen. They led to ridges so narrow and so steep on both sides that straddling was the easiest solution. At times, the pain and loneliness overwhelmed him, and he broke down and cried. After 81 days of exhausting, extremely hazardous climbing, Waterman reached the 14,573-foot summit of Hunter, which rises in the Alaska Range immediately south of Denali. Another 9 weeks were required to make the only slightly less harrowing descent. In total, Waterman spent 145 days alone on the mountain. When he got back to civilization, flat broke, he borrowed $20 from Cliff Hudson, the bush pilot who'd flown him out of the mountains, and returned to Fairbanks, where the only work he could find was washing dishes. Waterman was nevertheless hailed as a hero by the small fraternity of Fairbanks climbers. He gave a public slideshow of the Hunter ascent that Brady calls unforgettable. It was an incredible performance, completely uninhibited. He poured out all his thoughts and feelings, his fear of failure, his fear of death. It was like you were there with him. In the months following the epic deed, though, Waterman discovered that instead of putting his demons to rest, success had merely agitated them. Waterman's mind began to unravel. John was very self-critical, always analyzing himself, Brady recalls, and he'd always been kind of compulsive. He used to carry around a stack of clipboards and notepads. He'd take copious notes, creating a complete record of everything he did during the course of each day. I remember running into him once in downtown Fairbanks. As I walked up, he got out a clipboard, logged in the time he saw me, and recorded what our conversation was about, which wasn't much at all. His notes on our meeting were 3 or 4 pages down, behind all the other stuff he'd already scribbled that day. Somewhere he must have had piles and piles and piles of notes like that, which I'm sure would have made sense to no one except John. Soon thereafter, Waterman ran for the local school board on a platform promoting unrestricted sex for students and the legalization of hallucinogenic drugs. He lost the election, to nobody's surprise save his own, but immediately launched another political campaign, this time for the presidency of the United States. He ran under the banner of the Feed the Starving Party, the main priority of which was to ensure that nobody on the planet died of hunger. To publicize his campaign, he laid plans to make a solo ascent of the south face of Denali, the mountain's steepest aspect, in winter, with a minimum of food. He wanted to underscore the waste and immorality of the standard American diet. As part of his training regimen for the climb, he immersed himself in bathtubs filled with ice. Waterman flew to the Kehiltna Glacier in December 1979 to begin the ascent, but called it off after only 14 days. "Take me home," he reportedly told his bush pilot. "I don't want to die." 2 months later, however, he prepared for a second attempt. But in Talkeetna, a village south of Denali that is the point of embarkation for most mountaineering expeditions into the Alaska Range, the cabin he was staying in caught fire and burned to rubble, incinerating both his equipment and the voluminous accumulation of notes, poetry, and personal journals that he regarded as his life's work. Waterman was completely unhelmed by the loss. A day after the fire, he committed himself to the Anchorage Psychiatric Institute, but left after 2 weeks, convinced there was a conspiracy afoot to put him away permanently. Then, in the winter of 1981, he launched yet another solo attempt on Denali. As if climbing the peak alone in winter weren't challenging enough, this time he decided to up the ante even further by beginning his ascent at sea level, which entailed walking 160 hard, circuitous miles from the shore of Cook Inlet just to reach the foot of the mountain. He started plodding north from Tidewater in February, but his enthusiasm fizzled on the lower reaches of the Ruth Glacier, still 30 miles from the peak, so he aborted the attempt and retreated to Talkeetna. In March, however, he mustered his resolve once more and resumed his lonely trek. Before leaving town, he told the pilot Cliff Hudson, whom he regarded as a friend, "I won't be seeing you again." It was an exceptionally cold March in the Alaska Range. Late in the month, Muggs Stump crossed paths with Waterman on the upper Ruth Glacier. Stump, an alpinist of world renown who died on Denali in 1992, had just completed a difficult new route on a nearby peak, the Moose's Tooth. Shortly after his chance encounter with Waterman, Stump visited me in Seattle and remarked that John didn't seem like he was all there. He was acting spacey and talking some crazy shit. Supposedly, he was doing this big winter ascent of Denali, but he had hardly any gear with him. He was wearing a cheap one-piece snowmobile suit and wasn't even carrying a sleeping bag. All he had in the way of food was a bunch of flour, some sugar, and a big can of Crisco. In his book Breaking Point, Glenn Randall writes, "For several weeks, Waterman lingered in the area of the Sheldon Mountain House, a small cabin perched on the side of the Ruth Glacier in the heart of the range. Kate Bull, a friend of Waterman's who was climbing in the area at the time, reported that he was run down and less cautious than usual. He used the radio he had borrowed from Cliff Hudson to call him and have him fly in more supplies. Then he returned the radio he had borrowed. 'I won't be needing this anymore,' he said. 'The radio would have been his only means of calling for help.'" Waterman was last placed on the northwest fork of the Ruth Glacier on April 1st. His tracks led toward the east buttress of Denali, straight through a labyrinth of giant crevasses, evidence that he had made no apparent effort to circumvent obvious hazards. He was not seen again. It is assumed he broke through a thin snow bridge and plummeted to his death at the bottom of one of the deep fissures. The National Park Service searched Waterman's intended route from the air for a week following his disappearance, but found no sign of him. Some climbers later discovered a note atop a box of Waterman's gear inside the Sheldon Mountain House. 3/13/81, it read. My last kiss, 1:42 p.m. Perhaps inevitably, parallels have been drawn between John Waterman and Chris McCandless. Comparisons have also been drawn between McCandless and Carl McCunn, an affable, absent-minded Texan who moved to Fairbanks during the 1970s oil boom and found lucrative employment on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline construction project. In early March 1981, as Waterman was making his final journey into the Alaska Range, McCunn hired a bush pilot to drop him at a remote lake near the Colleen River, about 75 miles northeast of Fort Yukon on the southern margin of the Brooks Range. A 35-year-old amateur photographer, McCunn told friends that the main reason for the trip was to shoot pictures of wildlife. He flew into the country with 500 rolls of film, 22 and 30-30 caliber rifles, a shotgun, and 1,400 pounds of provisions. His intention was to remain in the wilderness through August. Somehow, though, he neglected to arrange for the pilot to fly him back to civilization at summer's end, and it cost McCunn his life. This astounding oversight wasn't a great surprise to Mark Stoppel, a young Fairbanks resident who had come to know McCunn well during the 9 months they worked on the pipeline together, shortly before the lanky Texan departed for the Brooks Range. Carl was a friendly, extremely popular, down-home sort of guy, Stoppel recalls, and he seemed like a smart guy, but there was a side to him that was a little bit dreamy, a little bit out of touch with reality. He was flamboyant. He liked to party hard. He could be extremely responsible, but he had a tendency to wing it sometimes, to act impulsively, to get by on bravado and style. No, I guess it really doesn't surprise me that Carl went out there and forgot to arrange to be picked up. But then I'm not easily shocked. I've had several friends who drowned or got murdered or died in weird accidents. In Alaska, you get used to strange stuff happening. In late August, as the days grew shorter and the air turned sharp and autumnal in the Brooks Range, McCunn began to worry when nobody arrived to fly him out. I think I should have used more foresight about arranging my departure, he confessed to his diary, significant portions of which were published posthumously in a 5-part story by Chris Capps in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. I'll soon find out. Week by week, he could feel the accelerating advance of winter. As his food supply grew meager, McCunn deeply regretted tossing all but a dozen of his shotgun shells into the lake. I keep thinking of all the shotgun shells I threw away about 2 months ago, he wrote. Had 5 boxes, and when I kept seeing them sitting there, I felt rather silly for having brought so many. Felt like a warmonger. Real bright. Who would have known I might need them just to keep from starving? Then, on a brisk September morning, deliverance seemed to be at hand. McCunn was stalking ducks with what remained of his ammunition when the stillness was rocked by the buzz of an airplane, which soon appeared overhead. The pilot, spotting the camp, circled twice at a low altitude for a closer look. McCunn waved wildly with a fluorescent orange sleeping bag cover. The aircraft was equipped with wheels rather than floats and thus couldn't land, but McCunn was certain he'd been seen and had no doubt the pilot would summon a float plane to return for him. He was so sure of this, he recorded in the journal that, I stopped waving after the first pass. I then got busy packing things up and getting ready to break camp. But no airplane arrived that day, or the next day, or the next. Eventually, McCunn looked on the back of his hunting license and understood why. Printed on the little square of paper were drawings of emergency hand signals for communicating with aircraft from the ground. I recall raising my right hand, shoulder high, and shaking my fist on the plane's second pass, McCunn wrote. It was a little cheer, like when your team scored a touchdown or something. Unfortunately, as he learned too late, raising a single arm is the universally recognized signal for all okay, assistance not necessary. The signal for SOS, send immediate help, is 2 upraised arms. That's probably why, after they flew somewhat away, they returned for 1 more pass, and on that one I gave no signal at all. In fact, I may have even turned my back to the plane as it passed, McCunn mused philosophically. They probably blew me off as a weirdo. By the end of September, snow was piling up on the tundra, and the lake had frozen over. As the provisions he'd brought ran out, McCunn made an effort to gather rose hips and snare rabbits. At one point, he managed to scavenge meat from a diseased caribou that had wandered into the lake and died. By October, however, he had metabolized most of his body fat and was having difficulty staying warm during the long, cold nights. "Certainly someone in town should have figured something must be wrong, me not being back by now," he noted. But still, no plane appeared. "It would be just like Carl to assume that somebody would magically appear to save him," says Stoppel. "He was a teamster. He drove a truck. So he had plenty of downtime on the job, just sitting on his butt inside his rig, daydreaming, which is how he came up with the idea for the Brooks Range trip. It was a serious quest for him. He spent the better part of a year thinking about it, planning it, figuring it out, talking to me during our breaks about what gear to take. But for all the careful planning he did, he also indulged in some wild fantasies. For instance," Stoppel continues, "Carl didn't want to fly into the bush alone. His big dream, originally, was to go off and live in the woods with some beautiful woman. He was hot for at least a couple of different girls who worked with us, and he spent a lot of time and energy trying to talk Sue or Barbara or whoever into accompanying him, which in itself was pretty much pure fantasy land. There was no way it was going to happen. I mean, at the pipeline camp where we worked, Pump Station 7, there were probably 40 guys for every woman. But Carl was a dreaming kind of dude, and right up until he flew into the Brooks Range, he kept hoping and hoping and hoping that one of these girls would change her mind and decide to go with him. Similarly," Stoppel explains, "Carl was the sort of guy who would have unrealistic expectations that someone would eventually figure out he was in trouble and cover for him. Even as he was on the verge of starving, he probably still imagined that Big Sue was going to fly in at the last minute with a plane load of food and have this wild romance with him. But his fantasy world was so far off the scale that nobody was able to connect with it. Carl just got hungrier and hungrier. By the time he finally understood that nobody was going to come rescue him, he'd shriveled up to the point where it was too late for him to do anything about it." As McCunn's food supply dwindled to almost nothing, he wrote in his journal, "I'm getting more than worried. To be honest, I'm starting to be a bit scared." The thermometer dipped to -5 degrees Fahrenheit. Painful, pus-filled frostbite blisters formed on his fingers and toes. In November, he finished the last of his rations. He felt weak and dizzy. Chills racked his gaunt frame. The diary recorded, "Hands and nose continue to get worse, as do feet. Nose tip very swollen, blistered, and scabbed. This is sure a slow and agonizing way to die." McCunn considered leaving the security of his camp and setting out on foot for Fort Yukon, but concluded he wasn't strong enough, that he would succumb to exhaustion and the cold long before he got there. "The part of the interior where Carl went is a remote, very blank part of Alaska," says Stoppel. "It gets colder than hell there in winter. Some people in his situation could have figured out a way to walk out, or maybe winter over. But to do that, you'd have to be extremely resourceful. You'd really need to have your shit together. You'd have to be a tiger, a killer, a fucking animal. And Carl was too laid back. He was a party boy." "I can't go on like this. I'm afraid," McCunn wrote sometime in late November near the end of his journal, which by now filled 100 sheets of blue-lined loose-leaf notebook paper. "Dear God in heaven, please forgive me my weakness and my sins. Please look over my family." And then he reclined in his wall tent, placed the muzzle of the .30-30 against his head, and jerked his thumb down on the trigger. 2 months later, on February 2, 1982, Alaska State troopers came across his camp, looked inside the tent, and discovered the emaciated corpse frozen hard as stone. There are similarities among Rossellini, Waterman, McCunn, and McCandless. Like Rossellini and Waterman, McCandless was a seeker and had an impractical fascination with the harsh side of nature. Like Waterman and McCunn, he displayed a staggering paucity of common sense. But unlike Waterman, McCandless wasn't mentally ill, and unlike McCunn, he didn't go into the bush assuming someone would automatically appear to save his bacon before he came to grief. McCandless didn't conform particularly well to the bush casualty stereotype. Although he was rash, untutored in the ways of the backcountry, and incautious to the point of foolhardiness, he wasn't incompetent. He wouldn't have lasted 113 days if he were. And he wasn't a nutcase. He wasn't a sociopath. He wasn't an outcast. McCandless was something else, although precisely what is hard to say. A pilgrim, perhaps. Some insight into the tragedy of Chris McCandless can be gained by studying predecessors cut from the same exotic cloth. And in order to do that, one must look beyond Alaska, to the bald rock canyons of southern Utah. There, in 1934, a peculiar 20-year-old boy walked into the desert and never came out. His name was Everett Royce. Chapter 9. Davis Gulch. As to when I shall visit civilization, it will not be soon, I think. I have not tired of the wilderness. Rather, I enjoy its beauty and the vagrant life I lead more keenly all the time. I prefer the saddle to the streetcar and star-sprinkled sky to a roof, the obscure and difficult trail leading into the unknown to any paved highway, and the deep peace of the wild to the discontent bred by cities. Do you blame me, then, for staying here, where I feel that I belong and am one with the world around me? It is true that I miss intelligent companionship, but there are so few with whom I can share the things that mean so much to me that I have learned to contain myself. It is enough that I am surrounded with beauty. Even from your scant description, I know that I could not bear the routine and humdrum of the life that you are forced to lead. I don't think I could ever settle down. I have known too much of the depths of life already, and I would prefer anything to an anticlimax. The last letter ever received from Everett Royce to his brother Waldo, dated November 11th, 1934. What Everett Royce was after was beauty, and he conceived beauty in pretty romantic terms. We might be inclined to laugh at the extravagance of his beauty worship if there were not something almost magnificent in his single-minded dedication to it. Aesthetics as a parlor affectation is ludicrous and sometimes a little obscene. As a way of life, it sometimes attains dignity. If we laugh at Everett Royce, we shall have to laugh at John Muir, because there was little difference between them except age. Wallace Stegner, Mormon Country. Davis Creek is only a trickle during most of the year, and sometimes not even that. Originating at the foot of a high rock battlement known as 50 Mile Point, the stream flows just 4 miles across the pink sandstone slabs of southern Utah before surrendering its modest waters to Lake Powell, the giant reservoir that stretches 190 miles above Glen Canyon Dam. Davis Gulch is a small watershed by any measure, but a lovely one, and travelers through this dry, hard country have for centuries relied on the oasis that exists at the bottom of the slot-like defile. Eerie 900-year-old petroglyphs and pictographs decorate its sheer walls. Crumbling stone dwellings of the long-vanished Kayenta Anasazi, the creators of this rock art, nestle in protective nooks. Ancient Anasazi potsherds mingle in the sand, with rusty tin cans discarded by turn-of-the-century stockmen who grazed and watered their animals in the canyon. For most of its short length, Davis Gulch exists as a deep, twisting gash in the slick rock, narrow enough in places to spit across, lined by overhanging sandstone walls that bar access to the canyon floor. There is a hidden route into the gulch at its lower end, however. Just upstream from where Davis Creek flows into Lake Powell, a natural ramp zigzags down from the canyon's west rim. Not far above the creek bottom, the ramp ends, and a crude staircase appears, chiseled into the soft sandstone by Mormon cattlemen nearly a century ago. The country surrounding Davis Gulch is a desiccated expanse of bald rock and brick-red sand. Vegetation is lean. Shade from the withering sun is virtually non-existent. To descend into the confines of the canyon, however, is to arrive in another world. Cottonwoods lean gracefully over drifts of flowering prickly pear. Tall grasses sway in the breeze. The ephemeral bloom of a sego lily peaks from the toe of a 90-foot stone arch, and canyon wrens call back and forth in plaintive tones from a thatch of scrub oak. High above the creek, a spring seeps from the cliff face, irrigating a growth of moss and maidenhair fern that hangs from the rock in lush green mats. 6 decades ago, in this enchanting hideaway, less than a mile downstream from where the Mormon steps meet the floor of the gulch, 20-year-old Everett Royce carved his nom de plume in